Hello, welcome to the HalfGuarded.com powwow. I'm your host, Zachary Big Chauncer Gilbert. This is my co-host, Danny Digwazer Ford. How you doing, mate?
How can you have me putting it down to me?
Hello, how we doing? We are here. We have not been taking another bridge. We are here on the, what you call, not the eve, I guess the Boxing Day. The British election. We may talk about that before the show ends. If you're listening to this, you probably look at some articles on Half Guarded. You've probably seen the coverage from Brits like Daza and other people. Much better than the coverage we'll give you later. But if you're fans of us for a long time, we did have our famous Brexit episode. So I think we will talk some British politics at the end. But Dan, here's your surprise question, though, of the week. Are you ready? You got your beer open? Are you ready? Ready for this?
Yeah, I'm ready to go. I'm drinking. Every time we do a podcast, like we record a podcast on the night of an election, it always goes super well.
It usually ends up with one of us, if not both, getting a little too drunk. We talk for like hours, like schoolgirls about politics. And they're like, oh yeah, we're supposed to do a show. And then if you... Our famous election episode we recorded, and it was instantly deleted by me as soon as I heard, like, the first 5 minutes. I was just like, nope, that ain't gonna work.
There's a lost copy of that episode I think I may still have buried somewhere.
Buried in the ocean. But here's our surprise topic of the week. It's Allen Iverson's birthday, Dan. So I want to ask you, what's Allen Iverson's legacy to you?
I would say, and I do not say this lightly, that he is the most iconic NBA player of the period of time between Jordan and LeBron. When you ask me to describe who was the guy of the NBA in between Jordan and LeBron, I would not pick Shaq. I would not pick Kobe. Vince Carter was almost there. And then
But he never had that.
Something Carter about him getting himself trading to the Nets. Like, he was
never had that run to the finals once he went to the Nets. Where Iverson was on a national stage. And I agree with your point, but I kind of feel like Iverson's, like, the fact that he was number one feels really outdated. It's like when you go back and look at the 80s top charts, and you're like, that band was the number one? I don't understand. But in the moment, Iverson made the perfect sense. Because he was this counterculture figure that we got after Jordan. I'm not bashing Jordan, but he was a very corporate guy. He was very calculated. And Iverson wasn't. He was very raw, and he was very in your face, you know? And to me, Iverson's one of my favorite, though.
Yeah.
He's one of the first black athletes, I feel like, in recent memory who spoke back to the media and, like, didn't really – maybe, like, Barkley might have been one of your first in the 90s, but he felt like one of the first of this recent age of black athletes who talk about things that are stupid or how they're affecting him and just was himself. He wasn't a – corporate calculated figure, like even like LeBron that we see today. He's very raw, and I love that about Iverson. One of my favorite players ever.
I don't think people totally realize in 2017 just how influential Allen Iverson was. Like, he's the single-handedly the reason why there's a dress code in the NBA, which is a thing people don't really talk about anymore because NBA players found a way to be subversive about the dress code and make it fit. Without all of them showing up dressed like Peyton Manning every week, the NBA players in a really cool way like subverted the whole point of the dress code. But like, he's the reason why there was a dress code,
and he was him. He was really one of those first athletes. I'm sure there were ones before, but he felt like one of the first, especially one of the first black athletes who's very in your face about who he was. He didn't hide the fact that he liked cornrows or like that he kind of had a shady past. He was like, whatever. You know, for better or worse. But and if you look at his style of play, look how it influenced. You can see today in Russell Westbrook. You can see another point guard. It's like he made point guard sexy again, too, which hadn't been a sexy position for a long time in the NBA.
He sort of, like, popularized the idea of a scoring point guard. Of, like, the point guard is going to be the main scoring threat, too. He did not have the three-point shooting ability that modern point guards have, like Russell Westbrook. You know, James Harden's not really a point guard, but...
But Isaiah Thomas might be the best modern-day comparison. They are both undersized scoring point guards, but Thomas can't hit the three, but like we said, it was a different basketball world. He didn't work on the three, back then. That was for pussies.
Yeah. Like, that's the that's the big difference between Iverson's era and today, is that everybody of that size is shooting three, whereas back then that still hadn't cemented.
And to be fair,
NBA
everyone of that size has to now, because now in the NBA we have guys who are 6'5", 250 pounds, who can run point. You know, like Reed Freaker and LeBron. You know, it's such a different time, but like, it's Iverson's birthday. Yeah. I didn't want.
Well, and the other thing about Iverson, though, and it's so, I think this would be very difficult to go back in time and sort of understand, is that you had to put in zone to ever stop Allen Iverson, because they have not made a living soul in God's green earth who could stay in front of Allen Iverson one on one. That man ain't been invented yet.
And then.
There ain't a man on earth he couldn't cross over.
Dan, I recently fired up the Sega Dreamcast. I fired up NBA 2K2, which would have been based on the 2001 season, the year Iverson went to the finals. I picked the 76ers to play my buddy, right? That team was awful. When I started playing with the team, I realized, how awful that team he took to the finals. I don't know if there's been a player that's carried a worse team to the finals. Even LeBron in, 04. This or 05 or whatever it was. This was much more impressive.
That last LeBron team was pretty terrible.
Yeah, the one with who was the Larry Hughes and whomever on the Cavs.
Larry Hughes was on Iverson's team. So
no, Hughes was also LeBron. So there we see the correlation between bad teams, and they pick up Larry Hughes.
Larry Hughes was the second best scorer on those Sixer teams. He was their second best scorer. Larry damn Hughes. You know who the second best player on that team was?
Who was? Theo Ratliff?
Matumbo. Theo Ratliff, maybe. I was going to say George Lynch. Because he was a really good perimeter defender.
Don't hate him, my boy Eric Snow. One of the most useless point guards in NBA history.
Eric Snow. Nobody could hate on Eric Snow more than Eric Snow's own DNA.
I don't
DNA.
Know if Eric Snow ever got above 75. In the NBA video games. Like, he may have always plateaued at, and that was a big overrating. Give him a 75.
Because, he sort of warped the video games because he was starting. It's like, he is starting on an NBA team. He's got to be at least 72. But it's like, he's Eric Snow.
Yeah, 65. Yeah. But, we saw that. But I bring up Eric Snow, a bit overrated there. And we're probably about to disagree on this statement, Dan, but to me, the most overrated coach in modern college football history retired this week, and that's Bob Stoops. But we very much disagree on Bob Stoops. So I'd like you to counter my point. Why is Bob Stoops not overrated, even though he only won one national championship?
Okay, winning one national championship is a tremendous accomplishment. Bobby Bowden won two. Steve Spurrier won one. The history of college football is that the system for picking a national champion is so stupid, it's so flawed, and so ridiculous that the fact that you got a chance to win one is a huge accomplishment. I mean, Joe Paterno, he's a piece of shit. He was a great football coach. He only won one. Bo Schembechler never won any national championship. So this notion that you can boil everything down to how many national championships you won, I think is a really ridiculous way of judging coaches in college football, given how screwed up the system is.
Because I saw this stat today. I think Skip Bayless made a really dumb point about this. Like, I'm not a Stoops fan, but I acknowledge probably a top 10, probably a top 25 coach ever. Someone maybe say top 10. I think he belongs like a 24. But there was a stat today. I think Bob Stoops was had 60-30 against top 25 teams all time? Something like that?
Yeah, he's got one of the greatest records against ranked coach teams in the history of college football.
The best coach of anybody in the modern era against top 25.
Yeah. The notion that, Bob Stoops couldn't win big games is so ludicrous when you consider that he basically single-handedly shut down the Texas football machine for, 10 years?
No, and realistically...
5-10 years. I mean, literally, until Vince Young walked onto Texas's campus, Texas could not beat Oklahoma.
Vince Young year was kind of that fluky Auburn year with Cam Newton, where it's just it was clearly that one player. It wasn't the program necessarily that won the championship.
Right. And then Colt McCoy, also they were able to Texas finally was able to start beating Oklahoma with Vince Young and Colt McCoy back to back. But Oklahoma was the graveyard. the Cotton Bowl is where Texas went to watch their season die every year when Oklahoma would beat them, sometimes by ridiculous margins. Like Oklahoma showing up and beating Texas like 63-3. And basically ending Chris Sims' career. Because by the time Chris Sims graduated from Texas, he just had this knock on him. It's like, yeah, that's that guy who gets devoured by Oklahoma. Like, I think Stephen Godfrey pointed this out. Like, there is no one program that did more to kill a single player than Oklahoma did to Chris Sims' career. It's just like, Chris Sims has a really good Texas career if you just leave out the fact that Oklahoma completely owned him every single time they played. I think the other thing that people, you know, when you're successful for as long as Bob Stoops was, 18 years, he was the longest tenured coach in college football, which is a bit screwy because Bill Snyder obviously spent so much time at Kansas State, but he had a break in between runs. But Bob Stoops had the longest uninterrupted run at a single school of any coach in college football. You tend to forget what it was like before he showed up. Before Bob Stoops showed up, Oklahoma was a place that people talked about like that place is never going to win football ever again. You know, Oklahoma was the dominant powerhouse of college football in the 50s and 60s, in large part because they figured out a scam of getting 29-year-old World War II vets and Korean War vets and giving them GI money to come to Oklahoma and play football. So while every other school was playing with college kids, they were playing with like 28-year-old veterans, which was part of what built the Oklahoma dynasty. And then in the 70s, Oklahoma was the first Southern school to really embrace playing black players under Barry Switzer. No, so that
I don't think that's a fair.
But by the time you get to the 80s,
can I stop you for a second?
By the time you get to the 80s,
for a second to make a point about Oklahoma doesn't really, and it's not like Oklahoma's the best. It's not the best institution in the world, but they do deserve some credit for being one of the first, you know, Southern-y schools to integrate. That's not a prop that Oklahoma doesn't get enough, in my opinion.
And I would say that's all Barry Switzer. I think that's – I don't even want to give this school that much credit for something.
Well, then they stayed out of Barry Switzer's way. I'll give them credit for not doing anything or not fighting Switzer that hard on that. I'm sure there were fights. But
Barry Switzer kind of single-handedly forced the integration of the Texas school because Oklahoma was not in the same conference as the Southwest. You know, the Texas schools were all in the Southwest Conference. Oklahoma was in the Big Eight. But Oklahoma would play Texas every year. And Oklahoma, you know, under Barry Switzer was just beating Texas like a drum, and that forced Texas to integrate. And once Texas integrated, the rest of the Southwest Conference integrated.
So that's something I do.
So he basically integrated two whole, you know, an entire.
So I didn't want to stop and give Oklahoma and especially Switzer, they deserve their due for that. You know, they're not heroes, but they, you know, the first person to do something right should get credit. Let's move on to Stoops.
But the thing about Oklahoma as a program is that by the time you get to the 80s, like the 80s Oklahoma Sooners are one of the most like comically, like flagrant violators of any basic rule of decency or standard. Like everybody wants to talk about when the U came out, that 30 for 30, like Miami became this poster child for schools that like don't follow any of the NCAA rules. And you know, obviously SMU, they had a 30 for 30 as well. Oklahoma was just as over the top as any of those schools. And they eventually got hit with NCAA violations. Their whole program went into the crapper in the 90s. And, you know, by the time Bob Stoops gets hired in 99, the theory going around is that Oklahoma can't compete in modern college football because they're not allowed to cheat because the NCAA's got a hard on for them. So if they try, the NCAA's going to drop a whole box of hammers on them. And Oklahoma can't compete being clean. That was everybody's theory. And then Bob Stoops comes from Florida. He's the defensive coordinator at the University of Florida under Steve Spurrier, when Florida finally wins their first national championship. And, you know, say what you want about Florida, say what you want about college football. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that any program is
clean. There's only one clean program.
But by NCAA major conference schedule standards, Steve Spurrier's Florida and Bob Stoops' Oklahoma are about as squeaky clean as you're going to be.
Well, besides, Dan, you're forgetting Holy Cross and Notre Dame. They're the finest.
Sure. Yeah, oh my God. They're blessed.
You've never seen anything at Notre Dame like a coach killing an assistant or like multiple guys with DUIs being allowed to play. because their dad worked for ESPN.
Or, you know, just like a game, ooh, right?
Yeah, that game. And then, a place like and then they make the girl kill herself because they kind of dox her. Yeah, nothing like that. But yeah, Oklahoma, though, Dan.
Yeah, that would never happen.
Stoops come in. Tell us, where did Stoops come from, though? Because he mentioned Spurrier. Yeah.
So Stoops's background is he's one of the 75 members of the Hayden Fry coaching tree. He played for Iowa under Hayden Fry. When he graduated, he ended up playing coaching at Kansas State for Bill Snyder, who also coached for Hayden Fry. He was the defensive coordinator for Kansas State as a very young coach. Bob Stoops was an incredibly young coach. Circle that. Well, that'll come back later. But Bob Stoops was an incredibly young coordinator. He was in his early 30s when he got his defensive coordinator job with Kansas State. And, you know, the story always goes that after Florida got humiliated in the 1995 national championship game against Nebraska, Steve Spurrier asked around at the coaching clinics, who is the best defensive coach in the Big Eight who can actually stop that Nebraska offense? And everybody told him, Bob Stoops, Kansas State is the only team that has any kind of hope against them. They're the only team that does anything worth a damn. And he called up Bob Stoops, you want to come work for me? And off Bob Stoops went to Florida, and that year they won a national championship. Bob Stoops brought a defense to Florida that finally was the missing piece that got Florida over the hump and into a national championship. But if we're going to boil down, especially his early philosophy, because it changed obviously as offense, but the big theory behind Bob Stoops was pressure, collapse the pocket, get the quarterback, zone blitz the hell out of him, drop guys back into coverage and confuse him and bring overload pressure from one side. The big trend in the 90s was to start moving to these pro style passing attacks. He short-circuited those by just devouring them with blitz pressure. And then against option teams, loading the box, playing that Bud Foster style eight man in the box, using that, you know, that hybrid safety. Roy Williams ended up being, you know, sort of like a fourth linebacker. Use that kind of pressure system to shut that type of offense down and just overload with numbers. And it was extremely successful, you know, all the way through the 90s and really up until teams started copying the spread offense that Oklahoma was one of the first purveyors of, you know, as far as major programs. The spread offense forced him to change. Defensively, I don't think they've been as good, but I mean, they've been pretty decent. I would not say Oklahoma's a bad defensive program, but that was the original philosophy of Bob Stoops. So, you know, he has all this success at Florida. Florida has one of their best runs with him as their defensive coordinator. There's a lot of belief that he kind of completes them as a program. He gets poached away by Oklahoma. Everybody at the time thought, well, he's going to bring one of Spurrier's assistants to come install Spurrier's offense, but he doesn't. And this is my favorite thing about Bob Stoops. This is why I'll always love Bob Stoops. He's a defensive coach, but his theory was when he got hired by Oklahoma, what is the one offense I can't stop? What is the one offense that gives me fit? And the answer was Kentucky under Hal Mumme. Every year they played Kentucky, Kentucky didn't have half the talent Florida did, and Kentucky would find a way to score touchdowns. Mm-hmm. He went, that's what I want. And he went and hired a guy by the name of Mike Leach, who you might have heard of, who was at the time Kentucky's offensive coordinator, and brought him to Oklahoma with him and said, look, whatever you want to do, whatever you want to install, I'm not going to touch it. I want your offense that you ran at Kentucky exactly how you ran it. I'll worry about the defense, but you give
me
that
offense. Okay, Dan, I want to stop you there. This is one of the things, this is how I kind of notice when someone's a great coach, because they don't try to exert control over things they know they're not good at. You know, I think back to, like, Saban trying to evolve his offense by bringing in Kiffin. I think of, you know, Belichick doing different things on offense because it fits his personnel. To me, that's one of the reasons Stoops is such a great coach. Like you said, because he allowed a guy like Leach to come in and do his own thing and didn't really get in his way. Not a lot of guys would do that, especially when you're getting like at a program like Oklahoma. You think he'd want to micromanage everything, but he didn't.
Especially defensive coaches. So many defensive coaches, like all they care about, it seems to be, is like their defense is stats. Like Buddy Ryan, famously in the NFL, where it's like he just wanted to run the ball 40 times a game, eat up as much clock as possible, and then make sure his defense was rested so they could go kill somebody. And it's like, there's a lot of defensive coaches who have that kind of flawed philosophy. And it's why so many defensive coaches turn out to be failed
and
head coaches.
I want to make this point.
More often than not, defensive coaches don't succeed.
And I've made this point about Stoops, especially when we talk about, I think I've made it when we talk about Kirby Smart. Traditionally, I think the only coach to have his first head coaching job as a defensive coordinator at a major program and be successful is Bob Stoops in the modern era. I don't think there's been another defensive coordinator to go to a top five conference school and be successful like Stoops has been without any prior head coaching.
Yeah, that's true, because Saban had a bunch of years as a small, you know, he was at Toledo and then to Michigan State. And, you know, I would argue that, you know, places like Toledo prepared Nick Saban for the idea that no matter how much he loves his defense, he's going to have to score some points to win any games. And you're not going to have all the players you want, so you better do something to get some points. I would say Pete Carroll was an NFL head coach. He's a defensive guy.
There's not many other DCs that have been successful without head coach. Now, offensive coordinators tend to be different.
Charlie Strong went from Florida to Louisville, and he was successful. But then he did bomb at Texas. But his first head coaching job, he did
Louisville well. Louisville was still in Conference USA then, right? Or the Big East. So they weren't in the top five. Big East. Sorry, Big East. You never counted. I don't know what to tell you. You didn't. No one ever.
Yeah. I mean,
when South Florida was number two, I think we all knew that was one of the bigger jokes in the history of college football. That was it 07? Yeah.
Yeah. That was the weirdest year in college football history was 07. That's the year that LSU won the national championship with two losses. That's how
was
weird
that also
a year that
was. Is that the year Stoops also got upset by Boise?
Yeah. Yes.
So,
I believe.
But I want to talk about that real quick, though, because we understand Stoops established himself, very successful Oklahoma, wins the national championship. But where does this rep of him, like, losing the big game, how does that happen? Because he clearly had to lose a couple of big games to get this reputation. And I feel like this reputation is a new thing that Stoops has gotten over the past 10 years.
Well, like, the big game Bob thing was originally, like, unironic. Like, people were just like, man, he wins a lot of big games. I think all that was is, like, you know, the classic statistical example of reversion to the mean. Like, Bob Stoops coached for 18 years at a major conference, you know, program. When he first got there, they had a ton of success. And eventually, that had to revert a little bit back to the mean. Like, you're not going to have a 900 winning percentage against ranked teams forever. Eventually, you're going to start losing some big games if you coach enough of them. The fact that he still ended up with a tremendous record against the top 25 is proof positive he was a great coach. But because he started off on such a hot streak, eventually he was going to come back a little bit, and that became fodder for mockery there's nothing in sports truer about Americans that we love to piss on somebody when they've had a
lot
of success.
There's nothing Americans,
you know, especially if they start looking like they're falling down.
America is the Rocky series. Actually, we love to build an underdog up. When he gets to the top, we love to tear him down, but then we love to watch him come back, and that's America.
And then end up, like, all the way back. I mean, if we're talking about the Rocky series, at the end of that, he ends up, like, with brain damage.
No, he ends up, Rocky Balboa comes back, he fights, and then in Creed, he's a coach. So it ends,
Mason's Aline Dixon. Do not forget that
name. That
might
be a summer review series.
He was Mason.
Coming up, by the way.
The Line.
We may go
Dixon.
Back and look at some of the Rocky.
I think I'll force you to watch Rocky
I've
Five
never watched.
My continuing quest
I have the,
to make you kill yourself.
Side thing, I got the Rocky DVDs for Christmas one year. Watched 1, 2, 3, 4, got the 5, watched the first 10 minutes, said nope. I skipped to the end, they didn't even do the Rocky music right. One of the worst movies I've ever seen in my life, Rocky Five. Fuck Rocky Five.
You didn't really see it, but, I mean...
Well, and they do, like, the weird Johnny Cochran
thing. It's, I think...
Or I guess that's supposed to be Don King.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was Don King, not Johnny Cochran. Also, it had a real-life person who lived with HIV, Tommy Morrison, playing Tommy the Machine Gun.
So, yeah, but back to Stoops. It gets this reputation of like blowing the big games. Like you said, he clearly just is regressing. That's how math works. But do you think that Boise State loss hurts his legacy a little bit, looking back on things?
I think no, because Oklahoma had that comeback, you know, after that. Like, the Boise game was kind of, in some ways, the end of the first era of Oklahoma. But then they sort of reformed, you know, reoriented themselves, and then had another run, which culminated in, you know, them making the playoff, and, you know, they had the bowl victory over Alabama. Like, he got the program back to a 10-11 win.
Yeah, he kind of modernized that program for the next decade. So, like, now as we look at Oklahoma, Dan, and we'll have another show where we kind of look at Bob Stoops in depth. I think he kind of deserves a full show later on. But where does Oklahoma go now?
Well, I think the interesting thing about Bob Stoops, and I do not think this is surprising, of all the guys to retire young, Bob Stoops is a guy that people have talked about maybe, like, this didn't come out of nowhere. Like, Bob Stoops is a guy that people have talked about for a while now that maybe his heart wasn't quite in it the same way as it used to be. There was a lot of talk, you know, that his dad died at 55 of a heart attack coaching a high school football game. And he's 56, and that was a part of his decision making. I think another aspect of why he's retiring is just coaches make way more money than they used to. You know, he's made a shit ton of money. He's financially set in a way that, you know, you maybe weren't, you know, 25 years ago, like where you coached until you died because it's the only way you had money, you know. But I think it's the one thing that's been sort of remarkable since the retirement is how many people have come out of the woodwork talking about how, and I think this is directly related to Spurrier. Bob Stoops and Steve Spurrier are the two coaches everybody talks about. There's not two better coaches to work for in the history of college football.
You don't hear a lot of negative stuff about Bob. Until recently with the Joe Mixon stuff.
I would say
didn't ever see him in the headlines like with something like that until recently. And maybe that was part of the reason for Stoops stepping out, because he realized with social media now, it's kind of hard not to tarnish your legacy. If you stick around for a long time, regardless.
Yeah, I think that mattered to him too. I think it mattered. I think a thing that mattered a lot to him was watching Spurrier end, because those two were very, very close for a long time. Like, they would go play golf every summer.
Not like a mentor apprenticeship, but like kind of a, you know, maybe a, yeah.
They were. Like, Spurrier was a mentor to Bob Stoops in a lot of ways. And I think even though Bob Stoops kind of got his big break coaching for Bill Snyder, Bob Stoops is a lot more like Spurrier than Bill Snyder, because Bill Snyder is like the classic workaholic, you know,
we'll get into Bill Snyder's a piece of shit in the show, actually. That might be my fuck you of the week, actually.
Yeah, but like Bill Snyder is the classic, like, I will work until I drop because it is all I know how to do.
And a guy who clearly doesn't really care about his players, and I always got the vibe from Spurrier and Stoops that they did, like, even if you look at the Joe Mixon thing, I think Stoops believed he could help Joe Mixon become a better man. If that's fair. Now, maybe it's not the best way to do it with him getting a free ride to college, but still, Stoops seems like a guy who does legit care about his players. He's not a guy who's going to harm his players in any way. Is that fair to say, Dan?
Bill Snyder, there's a reason why Bill Snyder's made his career off JUCOs, and that's their players who are completely and totally dependent on him, who will put up with
but
all
Stoops
of his
Stoops seems bullshit. Like a one of, maybe not the best guy, but one of the rare, maybe good guys in college football. Is that fair to say, Dan?
I would say you just listen to people who, like, especially the wives of coaches who've worked for Bob Stoops, who will, like, come out of the woodwork saying, my husband worked for, like, all these coaches in his coaching career, and this was a miserable job for our family. When he worked for Bob Stoops, that was the one point in our lives where we had, like, any kind of work-life balance, and he was always, like, bending over backwards to accommodate any kind of family issue. He wasn't, like, football comes first, second, third. I mean, there's a reason why Bob Stoops hates Nick Saban, and it's not Nick Saban wins a lot. I think Bob Stoops genuinely looks at Nick Saban and says he's everything wrong with our profession.
I don't disagree. I don't necessarily
he
disagree.
He is a win
that.
At whatever account, and throw all the players into a meat grinder, throw coaches into a meat grinder, use human beings, just use and abuse them, and drain every last bit out of people that you can. And then move on to the next thing.
So are you saying Stoops, in the spirit of Switzer, might have some of that compassion that we don't see a lot in coaches? Like, Would you say that's in his spirit? A guy who's a good guy, who's also a head football coach?
I would say Spurrier, without the quip.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's not as funny as Spurrier. And he's less of an asshole than Spurrier. Because Spurrier could be a real dick. Like, Spurrier allowed his coaches a good quality of life, but would then, shit on them. Which Bob Stoops didn't do that. So Bob Stoops was an even better boss than Spurrier. But, you know, I think he was a guy whose first and foremost was like, this is a job, but, let's not, let's not go crazy.
Think Stoops, you know, I mentioned the Mixon thing, but I think Stoops seems like a guy who wanted to be a molder of men. You know, I think he knew his role as a football coach. He understood what you are when you're a football coach, Dan. And I think we both kind of know when you're a football coach, you turn into a weird father figure. And from what I hear, it sounds like he embraced that role a little bit, where he wanted to help men grow up and help boys grow up into men. I think that's fair.
And here's another thing that tells you a little bit about Bob Stoops as a man. He's had the same president and the same athletic director the entire time he was at Oklahoma, if I'm not mistaken. I know he's had the same athletic director. They may have had a
different president. But it wasn't because he forced the president. It might have been for
the governor wanted to be president, a former governor. David Boren's a former politician who decided he wanted to be president of the school. But, Bob Stoops has had the same athletic director the entire time. How many major conference coaches don't get into, fights with their athletic director and then force them out and get, a toady in there? The guy who hired him, they've maintained a good working relationship, and they've stuck it out for 20 years almost, hand in hand. You don't see that in college football today. I don't want to keep harping on the Spurrier connection, but it's just I think of that Steve Spurrier quote where he's like, the athletic director, he's my boss, he pays me, I don't know why I want to fight with him. Bob Stoops just had that mentality that I think he learned that from Spurrier. You don't need to run the whole university. They pay you to be the football coach. Make them pay you. If Spurrier taught him anything, it's make sure your ass gets paid. But
don't worry.
But
worry about things you realistically can't control. Because like it or not, Stoops could never decide how the basketball program looks because you can't control that. You're not going to have definitive control where your image is made, you can't control a football program. So I think that was good of Stoops.
And maybe that's why guys like Bob Stoops and Steve Spurrier only won one national title and Saban won five.
Make $100,000. You don't need a million. Don't ruin your life. And get out early. You don't need the world. Get yours. Get out of there.
Have fun. Do your job. Be comfortable. And if you're good at it, you'll probably keep it for a long enough time.
But, and for Stoop, I'll say this, because I know you're listening, Bobby Stoop. If you're listening, go have fun with your family, because you deserve it. I may not like you, because I'm an SEC guy, and you maybe screwed over Auburn in 04, but that wasn't your fault. And B, besides the Mixon thing, I've never really not liked you for anything you've done personally, besides not liking the SEC. So,
I don't mean to be bringing up Spurrier so much, but I can't help it. Spurrier and Stoops are so linked. But it's like that Spurrier thing that he always harped on is that most people in this business either get fired or you end up being fired eventually. If you stick around it long enough, you will get fired. And,
to quote a great movie, Dan, you either die a hero or you live long enough to see yourself.
Oh, God. Batman quotes are like, to me, what Harry Potter quotes are to political Twitter.
As stupid as that movie is, Dan. That is true, though.
Bob Stoops is leaving.
I think that is a true thing, though, about college football. You either go out on the top, or you die the old man who won't fucking leave, or you turn into Bill Snyder or something, So good for Stoops.
Yeah, Bill Snyder defies all logic. He just keeps winning, at a high enough level that Kansas State's terrified. He'll put a gypsy curse on him, he did the first time they switched him out.
Will not be as kind to him. Stoops as well. So to wrap up our Stoops talk, good for you, Bobby. Like I said, have fun with your fam. You deserve it. Go spend those millions and get the fuck out of Oklahoma. Get to Florida or something.
And that brings us to Lincoln Riley, the new Oklahoma head coach. Lincoln Riley is a former Leach disciple. He played quarterback for Texas Tech when Leach got there. He had such a weak arm that Mike Leach cut him, which tells you how weak an arm you have to have for Mike Leach to say your arm's too weak. But you know, he got cut. He ended up staying on as a coach immediately upon graduation. Here he is at, you know, 33, I believe he is 33 or 34, and he's now a head coach at the University of Oklahoma. His first offensive coordinating job where he was the sole coordinator. Because he'd had other co-coordinator positions where, you know, he was basically a glorified wide receivers coach with a title. But his first real coordinator job was at East Carolina under Ruffin McNeil. You know, when Mike Leach got fired from Texas Tech, you know, Ruffin McNeil was Leach's defensive coordinator. Lincoln Riley was an assistant on the staff. The two of them both, you know, Ruffin McNeil's an East Carolina alum. He got the East Carolina job. Lincoln Riley came with him. And together they built a pretty successful mid-major program there at East Carolina, based around, you know, the awesome offense that Lincoln Riley had. And they did well enough that Oklahoma poached Lincoln Riley away, you know, when they decided, hey, we need to go back to our roots and be more of an air raid type team. It's paid major dividends for Oklahoma, and they like him enough that, you know, they never gave him the coach in waiting job because you don't really see coach in waitings anymore. That was a brief trend in the late 2000s, but then everybody realized it killed your recruiting because you were basically telling all recruits that the head coach is not going to be there too much longer. So they never called him coach in waiting, but he turned down some pretty damn good jobs to the point where people were going, you know, again, you're Bruce Feldmans of the world who are very plugged in to the coaching world and the coaching carousel. You know, they all started saying, you know, he seems like he's waiting for this Oklahoma job. Because he turned down the Houston job, he turned down the Texas Tech job, and that's his alma mater. You know, he showed no interest in the Texas A&M job when that was being talked about as maybe coming open. You know, he really wasn't showing a lot of interest in it. And when you see a guy like, you know, sort of not making moves at jobs like that, that kind of tells you he's something's up, right? You know, he's being told stick around. And I think Bob Stoops' timing in retiring makes it clear that Bob Stoops was probably telling him, look, you hang around here and you're going to have this job before too long. I'm going to make sure of it. The timing of Bob Stoops stepping down, that is a power move of this is the guy I want to replace me, because there's literally no one else you could hire given the time frame. So, you know, Bob Stoops believed in Lincoln Riley, and we're going to see. It didn't turn out well for Cliff Kingsbury at Texas Tech, so that's the big caveat.
Well, to be fair, Dan,
there's also the issue that Bob Stoops' brother is still the defensive coordinator, and Mark Stoops hasn't been very good in a while. So it's going to be interesting, Dan, to see how that all plays out.
It's a little
bit
easier to win at Oklahoma than it is to win at Texas Tech. I think that's
basically. Well, the issue at Texas Tech is not Cliff Kingsbury doesn't have the tools. It's that Cliff Kingsbury is clearly an incompetent dipshit.
Well, that's what I mean. You can be incompetent and still win a couple of bowl games.
Texas Tech's defense is so horrendous that goes back to the head coach not knowing what he's doing. You know, I could see the same thing happening with Lincoln Riley, where the defense just collapses and he has no idea how to fix it. We'll see, though. We'll see. He's definitely got a great pedigree. He's definitely a guy that a lot of people think highly of. He's not moving. You know, he knows the program well. He's been there for, you know, a while as an assistant coach. We'll see. I do like his odds better than Kingsbury, just because Bob Stoops thought he could do it, and I have a great respect for Bob Stoops' opinion.
Dan, let's jump over. Let's kind of cap this off. Let's jump over to people whose opinion I don't respect, and that's a lot of the pundits in the UK who maybe doubted Labour, and maybe we did too, Dan. Maybe we doubted this Jeremy Corbyn guy. Looks like Labour's going to gain some seats. We're going to have a hung parliament in the UK. Can you kind of just...
The most seats Labour has gained...
Labour gained a seat in Canterbury, which has been controlled by the Tories of the Conservative Party since the 1800s. I was going to interrupt you with this earlier, but it looks like... God, what's that fucker's name? Nick Clegg. Is that the right name? Yeah, Nick Clegg. Out.
Yeah, fucking turncoat bastard.
He got voted out.
Fuck you, Nick Clegg! I'll never forget how he fucked... Yeah. Nick Clegg was the former... Was he still the leader of the Lib Dems, or had they replaced him?
I do not remember.
He was the leader of the Lib Dems in 2010, and the Liberal Democrats are sort of this like weird socially liberal but like fiscally centrist party. They sort of, the Lib Dems' entire existence is basically the result of the Iraq War, because Tony Blair, the biggest political dipshit of modern history, is Labor, but partnered with George W. Bush to lead, you know, the United Kingdom into the Iraq War, which sort of politically wrecked Labor, especially in England. You know, Labor remained pretty strong in Scotland, retained strength in Wales, and some in Northern Ireland, but really bled a lot of support in England, and the Lib Dems sort of moved into that opening. In 2010, the Liberal Democrats made a coalition with the Conservatives, which a lot of Lib Dem voters saw as a major betrayal, and it was Nick Clegg's big idea, and he never really recovered politically after leading the Lib Dems into that coalition.
Dead in the water tonight. So what does this mean? If you're an American, you see these results. Does this, because I think I know what it means for me. But it really means you're going to have a lot more assholes like me telling you Bernie would have won.
That's coming. That's coming, baby. I don't give a damn what you feel and what and how bad you don't like it. Bernie would have won is going to be blared out of a fucking open convertible right in front of you like it's a fucking 80s cop movie.
Yeah.
You know?
Because,
and you're being terrorized by minorities.
What this means for the UK in Labour, which people think of the UK and they think it's a socialist or it's some sort of lefty country. That's what a lot of Americans think of the UK, right?
Yeah.
It's a very conservative. I think what conservative has been in power since Thatcher, pretty much, for the most part.
Yeah. Well, Blair. No, that's not true. Blair won in 97?
Yeah, but he was mostly a conservative, though.
You know, sometimes around there.
He was way more conservative.
Well, he was a Clintonite. Yeah. He was like a Labour version of Clinton. Like, Tony Blair was Britain's Clinton. He led this movement called New Labour, which was very similar to the Atari Democrats, you know, which Clinton was a part of, and then that term fell out of use because Atari died as a company. But that's what they were calling them in the 80s, was like the New Democrats, which was a movement, you know, the Clintons were a part of. It was very similar to the Clintons. Hey, let's not make a big deal about unions. You know, let's move to the center on welfare. Let's move to the center on military policy.
To be fair, Dan, they moved more to the right and to the center, especially on welfare reform. More speaking about Clinton.
Well, that's what they would say. They would claim the center. What they really were doing was moving the Labour Party drastically to the right. And they were pretty successful in to be fair to Blair, I can't stand the guy, but call it spade a spade, they were pretty successful in they found an alchemy that worked right up until Tony Blair led them into Iraq.
Dan, you mentioned,
which was the moment that the whole new Labour
Can I drop some news right across the timeline here, speaking of Tony Blair? Looks like Corbyn wants to call a war crimes.
He killed himself.
If you're a lord, in England and you listen to this college football-based podcast, get the fuck out. You're screwed, man. If you've been fucking over poor people and you live in England, run. Run over here. I don't know where you go. Get out, because you're in trouble.
Yeah, they don't listen to our podcast. We're a podcast of the people.
Well, Sir Incest Lord listen. Sir Lord Incest. Listen.
Lord
Sisterfucker loves this show.
Lord Frogface is a huge, huge fan of our history episode on the XFL. He loved that shit.
Ooh. So
it's like Labor's last major success, you know, and it's very similar to the Democrats, where, you know, Labor got its teeth kicked in the 80s by Maggie Thatcher. And unlike in America, the teeth kicking continued into the 90s with John Major.
Well, you also didn't have her maybe back. She did. But she did have Thatcher kind of get exposed for war crimes, like Reagan and Iran-Contra. And I know Bush won the next year, but that didn't really help the Republicans. That scandal with Reagan is really downplayed now, but I think it was a bigger deal in the late 80s than people want to.
Also, Reagan destroyed the economy, which is what ultimately killed Bush. It's like when the economy collapsed in 86, like that caused a recession, which sort of doomed the old man Bush. which didn't happen in the same degree in England. But the Labour, so many people involved with the Labour Party are still fixated on that period in the 90s and the 80s when they were getting their teeth kicked in and they felt they had to move further to the right. And it's like, yeah, at the time you probably did. You know, for political reasons, it was probably smart to move to the right. But that, like, this is the big thing that kills me about centrists. Their answer to everything is to move to the right on every issue. It's never, to me, my idea of what centrism is to put your finger in the air, judge the mood, and say, what is the popular position? And that's where I need to be right now. And if in 10 years I got to move off of it, okay. that's what being a centrist is. And to so many centrists in the Democratic Party and in the Labour Party, being a centrist just means, well, I'm for austerity, and I'm for welfare cutting, and I'm for endless military war, but I'm not gonna jerk off.
No. And I may pretend I'm not racist, but I'm not gonna do anything that would help marginalized minority groups. I just don't say the N-word. So I'm much better.
Like, I'm gonna be, I really deep down want to be a Republican, or deep down I really want to be a Tory, but like, my friends will make fun of me. So, like, so I'm gonna call myself a centrist.
But Dan, what this kind of victory, if you will, because it was a victory, because honestly, this was looking like it was supposed to be, what, a 30-seat gain for the Tories. They're gonna lose seats now. I think you said, what, the most seats they've lost since 96, or the most seats gained by the Labour Party? Yeah.
It's the most seats Labour have gained since 97.
So this is crazy, sure. And what I think we're seeing here, Dan, is the millennials, those damn millennials, this younger generation, they really like socialism.
We kill Red Robin, we're killing neoliberalism.
It's over.
We're killing everything.
And even if you look at how Trump kind of ran his campaign, to be honest, he did low-key do some socialist stuff, but we're not going to talk about that.
Well, he said he
never was going to, but
like,
he said
promised.
So he ran. He kind of stole Bernie
Sanders.
He promised enough stuff.
Enough people.
Yeah. People really won't say, but he did like rip off Bernie Sanders a lot.
Yeah.
But to me, what this says, this victory here, it tells me worldwide in Western states that young people are tired of the many having everything. I mean, of the few having everything and the many not. You know, we grew up through this recession where we bailed out the banks, Dan. Here in America and England, and what happened to these bankers? They stayed rich. They kept buying BMWs and Porsches for their kids. They stayed at the country club. They bought ponies for their daughters. Meanwhile, people who were working class lost their jobs. They lost their pensions. They lost their health care. They got nothing. And people saw what happened to their parents. They're saying, fuck that. We want to nationalize this stuff. Socialism, Dan, is on the rise. Sorry if that offends people, but that's how it is. Capitalism sucks.
And Britain has had brutal austerity since the 2008 financial crisis. They've shut down libraries. They've shut down police departments. You know, there have been these major, major cutbacks. To the point where there's some economists who are arguing that Britain's obsession with austerity, you know, the austerity plans that the Tories have pursued, has completely choked off the British economy. Like, even the screwball capitalists are saying that the conservative version of austerity has choked off the economy. They've been so austere.
Like you said, especially in Europe, though, we saw cuts to austerity. And then we didn't see like a big tax increase for, say, banks. We didn't see these banks that collapsed and had to be propped up. I know here, I want to say in the UK, there were bailouts also, correct? Or there were EU bailouts.
Yes.
And we didn't see those people suffer. We saw working class people suffer. And like I said, this younger generation saw this and they're tired of the bullshit. They didn't grow up with Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan's propaganda in their ears all the time. They grew up with failed Iraq wars. They grew up watching the rich get richer and their parents getting screwed over. They watched Bill Clinton screw over their families by cutting welfare. This is retribution for everything we've been mad about forever, Dan. And you know what? This was a victory for people like me today. I'm going to celebrate.
There's something else you pointed out there that I think is also important. Britain just had 2 terror attacks in the last month. And there was a time where terror attacks used to politically help strong defense conservatives. you know, when there'd be a terrorist attack, people would go to, like, that conservative promising retribution and promising military action and promising to get tough. The opposite seems to be happening, because we've had 15 years of never-ending wars in the Middle East, of this never-ending war on terror, and I think people are, it's finally starting to dawn on people that maybe the reason why we have all these increased terror attacks in the West has something to do with our never-ending war.
No,
in
and
the
not
Middle
even
East.
Never-ending war, but
that maybe those are
really
two connected
poorly
things.
Done war where in Iraq you literally created ISIS from like your fuck up. We've seen just constant failures by the West, the Middle East, and I think people are tired of it. They're saying, "Why is my grandma losing her health insurance, but we're dropping bombs in some country I can't even pick out on a map?" And you're spending how much money to do that? Fuck that.
And then the revelation that, you know, we have a terrorist whose family is relocated to Britain by British defense because they helped topple the Gaddafi government. And it's like, as a reward, they're then giving, you know, citizenship in Britain. And then they turn out to still be crazy psychos and, you know, plan jihadi attacks. It's like the realization that half the groups that we arm and back in the Middle East then turn out to be psychos who turn on us as soon as they get a chance. It's like people are just realizing that the entire way that the Western militaries and the Western intelligence systems have fought terrorism is totally fucked up and insane.
I think one of the best arguments for the UK people are like, if Corbyn gets elected, we'll have more attacks. And it's like, well, what the fuck have you done, Tories? We've had more attacks recently more than ever, and y'all have been in charge.
Yeah, it's like the same thing happened here. Like people have a hard time like now understanding it because Trump's, you know, this blithering moron. But like the reason why Trump stomped a mud hole and walked it dry in the Republican primary is because he was the one Republican who was willing to stand up and say that Bush era foreign policy was insane.
He was the one who criticized the
failed
Iraq war. He was the only one where you had Ted Cruz and Rubio just on their knees, not understanding what was going on. How can you attack war?
I mean, the death sentence to like Jeb Bush's political career, like the epitaph on his political career, was him saying, "My brother kept us safe." No, he didn't. And everybody knows he didn't.
No,
everybody.
Going to go back.
Your dad's Republicans, Democrats, moderates.
Your dad was at the CIA. Guess what? They led to the Taliban, buddy. You know, you talk about the attack in England. Who funded the Taliban to begin with in the 80s? But us. You know, 9/11 was on us.
Yeah, and it's just this realization. This realization is happening in England and in the United States, I think, where there's just this slow acknowledgement that maybe the policies that we have pursued for the last 20 years, especially the last 15, haven't worked. And it's not worth continuing.
No, and especially not...
That maybe we should try something else.
I think what a lot of America, and maybe Britons too, are learning, imperialism is fine and dandy. It ain't that cool when you're losing your healthcare. And
And it ain't that cool when you're being blown up, when it's not protecting you. Like, the whole point of all this strong defense, and we're going to spend all this money, is that it's supposed to keep you safe. Well, I don't think anybody in England feels too safe right now. I don't think anybody in England is going, "Oh man, I'm so glad we got Theresa May in there. We can't let that Corbyn fella get in there, or else we'd be in some real damn trouble."
Corbyn, the guy who wants to bring back the police force and bring more police, which is how you're going to stop terrorism domestically, is with more police. I hate to break the news to you. You know, you stop terrorism here, not over there. But that kind of wraps up for coverage, Dan. Any final kind of thoughts? Not really done with the UK election quite yet, but it looks like the exit polls will be right. We're going to see a major gain for the Labour Party. Will this matter in America at all? Or are we just stripped financial regulations for Wall Street again? Or will we not learn anything?
I don't think, I mean, obviously it's a different country, so it's not going to mean too much, but it might be a wake-up call for certain people, maybe.
Well, I can say, Dan, I will say, as someone who's admittedly on the left, I'm a card-carrying socialist base, I'm in the DSA, it's energizing, and it gets you want to go out. It makes me want to go out there and get people elected to my city council or my county commissionership who do have similar beliefs, you know, for working class people. It gets me fired up, and that's how you win elections. You don't win them with computers. You don't win them with money. You win them with groundwork. You win them with people. That's how Obama won. That's how Trump won to an extent. You win by motivating people to get out there and vote. And I think,
and I would also add that you know, Corbyn is in this position where he has had the greatest success that any Labour politician has had in 20 years, because on a grassroots level they took over the party, and they did it in a, you know, not too dissimilar from how the Tea Party took over the Republican Party. There are people who throw up their hands every time you suggest primarying Democrats who do not behave like Democrats, when people try to tell you that you're an idiot for wanting to get rid of Joe Manchin as the Democrat in West Virginia.
When you should know socialism doesn't play very well in West Virginia. I hate to break the news to you. Those people won't hire wages.
Don't listen to them.
Yeah.
Don't listen to these people. Embrace economic populism. Embrace, you know, cutting the defense budget, because the media will tell you you're an idiot, because the media has never had a war. No.
There's never been a war in American history
that the New York Times didn't
endure. People forget this, Dan. The media is full of idiots. The political class is full of morons and failed sons and failed daughters and spoiled people who've never been told they were wrong in their life. You know, you and me and our neighbor, when we organize, we can beat anybody. And that should be the lesson here. You know, if your beliefs are to get paid more, if you're at your job and you got a boss who's abusing you, get your workers together. See how long that boss lasts when everyone gets really mad about it. We, you know, the many can make change. And that's what I would take from this election. Regardless of whether it's your job, politics, arguing with the guy at the club, whatever, when people get together, we can be people who look more powerful than us individually. And that should be the lesson from this. We organize, we get out there, we can beat anything. We're all Rocky and Rocky IV, deep down. That's my final thing. Oh, my fuck you of the week. Fuck you, Bill Snyder, you're a slave master. That's my thoughts on that.
My fuck you of the week, J.K. Rowling.
And your books suck.
Write books about children.
So, Dan, let's get out of here, though.
I think that does it.
Fired up show.
All righty. Play the music, Jason. Play the music. This week, play Jerusalem.
God save the queen. Fuck the queen.